Welcome to the Radiation Research Podcast, your monthly radiation research vitamin. It's October 2008 and I am Massimo Pinto. Our interview of the month is curated by Sylvain. But first, let's hear some news from our very Varied.
Hi, and welcome to another News Minute with Varied. This month, I would like to give the opportunity for us to give us a shout out for our Facebook group. For those unfamiliar with Facebook, Facebook is a social networking website that provides free access for users to join, connect, and interact with other users. This podcast team has created a Facebook group conveniently named the Radiation Research Podcast Groupies. On the group's Facebook site, details of the current month's podcast is listed, as well as posts from the podcast team. The podcast team would like to invite our listeners to find us on Facebook and to befriend the group. We would like our Facebook group to be a unique method for us to interact with our listeners and to open up the podcast content for discussion and input from you guys. So please take this minute to sign up or sign in to Facebook and to join us at our online group, again titled the Radiation Research Podcast Groupies. You know you want to be a groupie too. This has been another Minute with Varied.
Coming up next, Sylvain's interview.
Welcome to the Radiation Research Podcast, October 2008. And this month we have an unusual topic, or I should say article, being selected. It's a meeting report dealing with decorporation agents, which are chelating agents used to remove radionuclide when a person has ingested or inhaled some radionuclide in their body, risking radiation poisoning. The title of the article is Medical Countermeasures Against Nuclear Threats, Radionuclide Decorporation Agents. The first author is Dr. Cassatt, which I will interview today. And the last author of the paper is Dr. Mendment. Dr. David Cassatt, thank you very much for accepting to be interviewed today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be talking to you.
So first of all, could you tell us a bit more about this workshop and why it was held?
Okay. The meeting was sponsored by NIH, and it started with a number of initiatives that we have funded, some contracts and grants for medical countermeasures against radiation, in particular decorporation agents. This would be something that could be used to give people in case of a dirty bomb or radiation dispersal device. So we have a number of projects that we're involved with, but we wanted to connect the new research with the older research and certainly try to get the background and the framework for the research that is currently being funded through NIH. So we included some people who had been working in the field for a number of years and who had worked for a number of animal models. We also had sort of to set the stage with the scenario of what could happen, put some of the research, and also with how some of these agents could be approved by the FDA.
Could you tell us a little bit about the different topics that were covered in that meeting?
Well, I think there were probably about 50 to 70 people there. This included within the government, the NIH. I think we also had Department of Homeland Security. People from Health and Human Services, our partners over at BARDA, which is Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. I don't know if I mentioned CDC, FDA, so a number of government agencies, as well as individuals from the national labs and other organizations that are doing some of the radionuclide research. We also had people who are active researchers for radionuclide chelation agents.
What is basically the type of events one would have to worry about and where we would need decorporation agents?
This would happen in case there is a radiation dispersal device or RDD or dirty bomb where you have radionuclide that's scattered over an area and people who are in the area could inhale some of the radionuclides or else they could ingest some of the radionuclides. And the problem is that once you get it in the body and it resides in the body for a long time, you can have some medical effects or adverse medical effects that happen downstream. So this is really to try to get the radionuclide out of the body, agents that can be used to do that, to decorporate the radionuclide.
So could you give us example of or events that took place in the world where such agents could be useful or have been used already?
Well, the... many times it's in facilities that are manufacturing various radioactive materials where there's an accidental ingestion. probably the one event that stands out was in Brazil and Goiânia, where there was a cesium source that was broken open, and the powder, which was nice glowing powder, was taken home by a number of people. Some of it was ingested either through eating or breathing. So a number of people became, I guess, contaminated with the material. So in that case, there was a decorporation agent, Prussian blue, that was given to the people that allowed for some decorporation material.
And was there any proof of efficiency in terms of the treatment?
Yes, there are a couple of papers that were published showing that there was reducing whole body committed radiation doses by up to a factor of 2. So this is with the Prussian blue.
And but that number comes from animal studies, right?
This was actually they monitored the people as they were getting the Prussian blue. Once they identified who was contaminated, they uh-huh. gave Prussian blue to those individuals and then monitored the radiation dose in them and also what was being excreted.
So basically, in the report, they also talk about that. I think it's SNS, the Security National Stockpile. So basically, if I understand correctly, the idea here is to have a repository of pills, of various type of pills for various type of contamination. And so one question I think that would come to most people would be how prepared are we in terms of a major radionuclide attack or radiological attack in terms of those chemicals? Are they readily available? How many people could you treat on the spot? How fast could you deliver it, which is a very important point here?
The agents that are available are first Prussian blue for cesium contamination, also zinc and calcium DTPA, which can be used for actinides or such as plutonium, americium, and curium. As far as logistics for getting it to people, I believe that they are trying to, certainly the sooner the better. I think in case of an RDD, we don't have a lot of infrastructure that is destroyed, unlike a nuclear device. So that there could be treatments of the number of people, and I believe that the numbers I've seen in other publications are in the range of maybe a couple hundred people. The difficulty is if it's something that is outside of these agents, there are methods for decorporation, but there are things like adjusting the pH of people by giving bicarbonate, etc. So there's a need to have more decorporation agents which have a broader range. Another difficulty is that for anything that DTPA is used for, it can only be given intravenously or by nebulizer, which is not necessarily suited for mass casualty situations. So something that can be given orally would be advantageous for this.
I see. And what about the, in terms of the program, the NIH must also be thinking about a way to train the different hospital to deal with this type of attack. And is there any program for this?
Not within NIH itself. There are different agencies within the U.S. government that are getting together to put together the guidelines for first responders, what should be done. For example, I think there are also guidelines from REACTS at Oak Ridge National Lab at Oak Ridge. And these are basically the first thing to do is decontamination of the people. Also to instruct first responders that it's okay to treat people, that there is not a huge risk of contamination for themselves. At first, you have to treat for injuries as well. So these are within other parts of the U.S. government, not necessarily NIH.
And could you comment a little bit on the different half-lives of those different radionuclides you're concerned about?
Well, the answer would be it depends on the agent. Certainly, anything that gets into the bones can have a longer end phase of the half-life, and it's difficult to get out, which causes the problems 10 years, 20 years down the line. So it really depends on which agent we're talking about for biological half-life. Something like cesium, which is throughout the water part of the body, may have a little bit shorter half-life. However, that can be increased by something like Prussian blue, which takes what's in the gut and then excretes it. So you have kind of a sink that's actually through the digestive tract.
Compared to heavy metal toxicity, the health effects associated with heavy metal radionuclides involve chemical as well as radiation effects. Could you comment on the concept that chelating agents would only remove the heavy metal radionuclide and only stop further the damage, but would not necessarily fix the chemical problem?
We're basically concerned about more of the radiation part of it. As far as the amount, the toxicity of the metal itself, usually there's not as much of a problem with that for most of these. Most of the toxicity comes from the radiation that's given off over time.
So obviously, all those studies require, ideally you would need to test on human, because that's the all the work's been done on animals. And from what I read on your paper, actually, there's a very strict protocol to work on animals as well.
I actually just want to go back. Probably the one nuclide that might be a chemical hazard would be uranium, just because it is a hazard as a chemical itself, which can be greater than the radiation hazard. But to go on to your question, the difficulty is you don't have a large population of people who are exposed to radioactive cesium, for example. So what the FDA has come up with is the animal rule, which allows for testing of products against conditions that cannot be ethically done in humans. So you can't give people radioactive cesium and see what happens by the decorporation agent. So it is a rather strict set of rules where for efficacy studies, instead of a phase 2 or 3 study in humans, you do GLP studies in animals. So there are some guidelines that the FDA has put forth to cover this that are fairly strict. So, for example, there are several linkages that we have to do between animals and humans of the drug itself, the pharmacokinetics of the drug, any kind of pharmacodynamics that might take place. The other part of it is that the animal model must come as close to the endpoint of the human condition as possible. For decorporation agents, this isn't terribly difficult because you're looking to decorporate materials from the animals. So you can look at output, which is an endpoint that is acceptable to the FDA, or body burden.
And could we do a simple experiment on humans, such as instead of having a radionuclide, looking at other type of material that someone could ingest that are not necessarily toxic to human, they don't have any radioactivity, but still have very similar chemical properties.
So it could be, if there are materials that are non-radioactive isotopes of a certain compound, then that could be given. As possible, something like cobalt comes to mind, but that would be something that the company would have to talk to, a company who's working on a decorporation agent would need to talk to the FDA about. So if there are instances where a non-radioactive isotope can be used, that might be something that is possible, and that could be worked out with the FDA. And if a human study can be done, that would be preferable to an animal study, according to the FDA.
So in your paper also, you mentioned the event of Alexander Litvinenko, the Russian spy who got poisoning with polonium.
Yes.
You mentioned then there's some work from, I think, Dr. Aposhin on new chelating agents that would actually deal specifically with polonium. Do you think, with hindsight, if we had known earlier what was going on with that person, do you think we could have that Alexander Litvinenko survive the exposure? Or,
well, that was a special situation where he died from acute radiation syndrome. So there are different ways to treat that. I think that certainly if they had known that he had been exposed to polonium fairly early and could have decorporated that might have helped him quite a bit. However, I think one difficulty is that once he got the acute radiation syndrome, there's a certain window that you can give a mitigator, for example, or a cytokine or something like that to treat that syndrome before all the organ failure occurs. So it's a difficult case.
I see. And actually, that's something I wanted to ask you, because I'm more working on the radiation biology side. And one thing I think would be worthwhile to look at in this program is the combination of those agents, those decorporation agents, with usage of other drug. For instance, it's been shown that you can block the hematopoietic syndrome by having an inhibitor of P53. I think it would be interesting to, merge those two techniques together in terms of a treatment where you block the current effect of the radiation as well as trying to get as much as you can out. Is it something that you're considering in the program, or are you trying to separate those two programs? So, okay, radiation biology on one side and decorporation agents on another side.
Right now, we do have them separated, mostly because the acute radiation syndrome is mostly through external sources of radiation, whereas most of the internal contaminants have a longer term effect. I think polonium is probably unique in that you can get the acute radiation syndrome from the radionuclide, but it's something that is worth thinking about. However, it's certainly right now they're in two separate spheres in our world.
Going towards the end of our interview, you mentioned in your paper a lot of new agents, chelating agents that are coming out. Anything that you want to mention that you thought was really very promising?
I guess it's kind of like asking which child do you like best.
I see.
So there are a number of approaches through improvements of DTPA to make that orally active. We also have the five different grants for siderophores of different types, amphipathic chelators, and biomaterials, et cetera. So really to choose among them is not something I want to do right now.
Okay.
But I think that certainly that, you know, hopefully there's enough information in the paper that people might want to start looking up some of these things, or actually wait for papers from the companies and organizations to be published.
What type of improvement you think we're going to get in terms of those chelating agents from what we have right now and where you think we're going to be in, let's say, 5 years from now?
Well, I don't know. That might be something to shoot for, the doubling. Maybe something better than that would be good as well. I think some of the difficulties are also for some of the metals that might incorporate into bone is to be able to get any of that out. So if you have a compound that could extract it from bone, you know, before it gets fully formed, because there's certainly an equilibrium that happens within the bone, to try to remove that, I think would be a big advantage for any type of compound.
Last question is, nuclear threats and accidents related to nuclear technology is becoming a more global problem. And so the question is whether more elaborative initiative from the international agencies like the IAEA would help tackle the problem globally. What do you think of that?
That sounds like a good idea. Right now, we are concerned primarily with threats to the U.S., but certainly whatever that we can do and that can help other countries naturally. Certainly, if there are other efforts out there that we can start to, I don't know if I'll merge them, but at least learn what other people are doing, would be helpful as well.
Well, that was very interesting. Do you want to add anything before we conclude this interview?
One thing that was nice is being able to really kind of link, put some of these programs in context, try to link some of the researchers who've been working on this for some time with some of the researchers who've come into the field fairly recently, and also to bring in the context of where this lays in as far as the countermeasures programs and also the future steps as defined by the FDA.
So actually it's a good plug here for people who are listening and regarding funding. So what type of fundings are we looking at?
Well, right now we are funding the programs that are in the paper as far as the contracts and some of the grants that are mentioned. We also have a site for radiation nuclear countermeasures, and any kind of funding initiatives would be on our website, www.niaid.nih.gov/research/topics/radnuke. So anything that we have, any funding opportunities would be there.
Well, thank you very much, David. And I hope to read more about all those nice studies.
Thank you very much for the interview, and goodbye.
That wraps up our October podcast. Do not forget to visit our Facebook group now. And until next time, goodbye.